If you would, turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 7. If you don't have a Bible and you'd like to go down halfway the aisles here on the banisters, you can grab one of our Bibles there to use for this morning. Daniel chapter 7 is where we'll be looking. Back in February, we began a study in the book of Daniel. And our plan then was to focus on the first six chapters. We called it God's People in a Foreign Land. It's the story of Daniel, a Jew, in Babylon during the time of the exile. So what I said when we began that back in February, that we'd stop after chapter 6 because the book really is made up of two different, very different parts. Chapters 1 through 6 are the history, the narrative of Daniel's experiences with kings, Babylonian kings. It's him interpreting their dreams and God working in the midst of these Babylonian kings through his prophet Daniel. Chapter 7 through 12 now record Daniel's visions he had himself, alone by himself, written down. And they're intermingled in the chronological level. They're intermingled throughout this time that we've already seen in chapters 1 through 6. So, for instance, in chapter 7, verse 1, it begins with, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon." The first year of Belshazzar was long before chapter 6. So Daniel's now recording for us some dreams and visions he had on his own that took place during the chronology of chapters 1 through 6. So on second thought, even though I said we'd stop after chapter 6 because we were trying to focus on God's people in a foreign land, on second thought, I thought we'd hang out in Daniel a little while longer and see some of this weird stuff. There's no other word for it. It's weird stuff, these prophecies he records. The biggest reason for us to spend just a few weeks in the chapters of 7 through 12 is the upcoming seminar weekend with G.K. Beale in May. May 18 through 20, it's a Friday night, a Saturday morning, all Saturday morning, and then Dr. Beale will be preaching for us on Sunday morning. So much of Daniel 7 through 12 is used in the book of Revelation. They're of the same kind of literature, what we call apocalyptic literature. Revelation borrows so much of its material from the Old Testament. Two-thirds of every verse in Revelation is an allusion or a paraphrase to an Old Testament passage. Two-thirds of every verse in the book of Revelation. So I thought we could take some time in Daniel to see some of it so that we would get excited about it before our seminar weekend and so that we could kind of get our wheels turning a little bit, kind of hit the ground running when Dr. Beale's here with us so that it's not entirely new to you. We tend to do this as Christians. We tend to either come across this weird stuff in the Bible, this symbolic, this apocalyptic end time symbolic stuff that seems weird to us. We tend to come across it and either become overly fascinated with it to the point that that becomes our everything. You know, you want to just solve everything. You know, the beast with eyes all around it in Revelation. You want to count the eyes and figure out what they mean. And you can, you know, you get the novels on it. You've bought the whole Tim LaHaye set twice, just in case one gets raptured away or something, I guess. But the other extreme is this, to come across the weird stuff and run from it. To be so afraid of it that no one gets it. This is horrible stuff. This is weird. And so I'm just going to skip it until Jesus comes back. He'll come back and I guess I'll get to experience it someday so I don't need to read it. So those extremes are not good extremes. We have to keep in mind that the book of Revelation and Daniel 7 through 12, pieces of literature in our Bibles much like this, are usually written to Christians or God's people in suffering times. And they're meant as comfort to God's people. Not confusion, but comfort to God's people in their suffering times. So think about this. You're confused right now. You're going through a trial right now. You're overwhelmed right now. Is it remotely in the back of your mind to pick up and read Revelation? You know, Lord, it's so hard right now. I guess I'll just turn to Revelation. And no one does that, right? We don't tend to do that. We just think it'd be more confusion, more worry or something. But you know what? It was written to first century Christians going through first century problems, immense, terrible suffering and persecution. And it was meant as a comfort to them. We call it apocalyptic literature. It's unusual for us because the style of literature is extinct. It's been extinct for almost 2,000 years. Now, we have something we call poetry, and we get that category. We get how to read it, and our minds adjust for it already. If I said, her eyes are like oceans, you know exactly what I mean. You don't think I mean big. Her eyes are as big as oceans. It's freaky. It's weird. She's all eyes, you know. Not a compliment. Not what you were trying to hope to communicate to your wife. Instead, you mean they're blue. They're, you know, they're engulfing. They enrapture me. They draw me in. They're beautiful. Well, just like we know to adjust for poetry when we hear it, first century people, people that Daniel was writing to, knew to adjust their mind, their thinking, to this thing of apocalyptic literature. The word apocalyptic is from the Greek apocalypsis in Revelation 1:1. It says this is the revelation, apocalypsis, of Jesus Christ. So instead of thinking apocalyptic equals doom, like you'd normally see on TV, if a TV show is called Revelation, I think it was called Revelations, wasn't it, with an S on the end, which is wrong, but they call it Revelations, and so you think doom, end times. Well, okay, but it means revelation. It means the revealing. The apocalypse is the revealing. Apocalyptic literature reveals secret things. Let me go through some bullet points. Apocalyptic literature is the revelation of secret things. Sometimes those secret things are in the future, and sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's a behind-the-scenes look at God's plan through the ages. It may even be historical at times. It has a heavy and seemingly weird use of symbolism. It uses like a poetry kind of sci-fi mixture. And we can start to get it. We can understand certain bullet points like these and find ourselves actually going to the book of Revelation for comfort. I don't want us to miss out on the intended purpose for this kind of literature in God's Word. I don't want us to either become obsessed with it, where we think that somehow godliness is mapped out and, you know, how many things you've got right on your dispensational chart. And if you don't know what a dispensational chart is, just thank God and don't worry about it. But some of you know, and some of you have like come across two different versions of one, and you go, oh no, which one is it? And so you try to nail it down a little bit more and maybe speculate as to what it could be. But the other extreme is to leave it, and we don't want to do that. We want to see these tools, these keys that would open doors for this kind of literature, not just being weird, but it being comforting and it painting a picture for us of the big picture, God's big picture, His plan. It describes things in the extremes, this kind of literature does. It isn't afraid of using the nth degree, we could say. So, you know, if you take it in this direction, it won't stop at kind of the median version of that. It goes to the nth degree of it. We could say it uses hyperbole almost without apology. Sometimes hyperbole is just lying. Right? Someone who says, well, I was just exaggerating. Well, you were lying. Come on. You're lying about your high school football years. You weren't that good. But sometimes hyperbole is, you get it. I think of our youth minister, Greg, who is given to hyperbole and, in an extreme level. I could say this in hyperbole. He uses hyperbole all the time. And it feels like that, but you get it. You know when he says, oh man, you know, like 10,000 of us were in the living room, and you know, he's just speaking youth ministry talk. He's just talking Greg. You get it. You adjust for it. And in Revelations like that, where it's painting things in their most ugly terms or their most glorious terms. The righteous are not kind of righteous. They're perfectly righteous. And the sinners are not kind of sinful. They're awfully sinful. It portrays the heinous ugliness of sin. It portrays sin in all its ugliness and all its heinous rebellion. It's meant as an encouragement, as I said already, for present suffering of God's people under wickedness. It's meant as that. So we have to read it in those terms. We have to think that it's a book or it's a chapter that we come across that's meant not just for the last generation who will be on the world, on this planet, but it's meant for the generation that got it in the first place, too, in first and foremost. It portrays a cosmic spiritual battle between good and evil, not dualism, where the black and the white are equal in fighting, and so sometimes good wins and sometimes bad wins, and we're not sure how it's all going to turn out. No, we know the end, but there is a real cosmic spiritual battle going on behind the scenes, even to this day, that we need to see. It does emphasize God's ultimate and final, His future victory. And in that sense, it's about the end. In that sense, it's about the consummation of all things. In that sense, it's about Jesus coming back. Yes, it is ultimately then about Christ. It's ultimately about Christ. Daniel 7 is ultimately about Christ. And it's written to suffering people in Babylon who weren't sure what's going on as king moves to king, moves to kingdom, and takes over another king, and takes over another kingdom. This king swapping through wars was going on right before their very eyes, and this gives them hope. So Daniel chapter 7 has two parts. The first 14 verses introduces the players and gives us Daniel's vision, what he sees. That's the vision. Then the second half of it, verses 15 to 28, explains what it means, interprets for us, draws some conclusions, what we'll call the explanation. So two parts to it. Let's look first at the vision, the first 14 verses. And the first part of the vision is four beasts. Four beasts in verses 1 through 8. Let's look at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. We'll read on more about these beasts in just a second, but we should see quickly that these four beasts equal four kings. Look at verse 17. This is an angel explaining to Daniel what he saw. The angel says, these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. So the beasts are actually men. They're actually real kings. This is a frequent thing in apocalyptic literature, by the way, for an angel to be there as kind of the narrator, as kind of the explainer of things. He's there as always one who's getting the revelation, can ask for clarification. So we'll jump ahead at times to see the angel's explanation when that's needful. Look back at verse 3. Notice it says that these beasts were coming up from the sea. We have to ask ourselves always with this kind of literature, how do they understand these things? How do they understand the symbols? What do they think of when they hear sea? Well, it doesn't take much reading at all in any commentary for you to see that in Hebrew literature and in Jewish culture, the sea was a frequent picture or a symbol of chaos, of violence, of destruction. I mean, guys were out there fishing and storms would come in, and this is a thing you can't control, but a thing you have to make your living by. The sea was representative of chaos, of almost of evil. In Revelation 13, Satan is described as a beast who comes up out of the sea. No coincidence there. And notice this, verse 2, they come from the four winds. What does that mean? I think this is a reference to the four points of the compass. You know, the north, south, the east, the west. I think it means they come from all different directions. So these are four bad kings coming from all different directions. They spring up like the wind springs up. What will become clear is they represent all the kingdoms that oppose God of all times in all places. Look at verses 4 through 8. Let's see these four beasts. The weird stuff. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. It was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth, between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And now verse 8 makes it further complicated. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among the 10 horns. Remember, the 10 horns are on the fourth beast. Keeping that straight. 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. Confused yet? Good. Well, let's do this. Let's take each one and look at it. And keep in mind that with this kind of literature, the picture that it's calling us to is one at a time. So you look at, for instance, what a lion represents, and then you look at what an eagle represents. You don't try to say, what's a lion eagle like? There's no such thing as a lion eagle. So a lion with wings like an eagle, those are two different pictures of one guy, of one kingdom. The lion, of course, represents kingship. He's the king of the jungle. He's strong. He's majestic. The eagle, what do you think of when you think of eagle eye? You think of vigilance, right? You think of nothing gets past an eagle, in a sense. I mean, eagle sees something coming from far away. No one sneaks up on an eagle to tackle it and go, I got you. No, you didn't get it. It'll fly away. It sees you. And so this lion-like king is great in his kingdom. He has dominion. He has majesty. There's a vigilance about him. He's aware. The second one is a bear which devours much meat. He's got a rib in his mouth. So, a bear, what do you think of when you think bear? You think, man, don't get tangled up with a bear. He'll eat you. There's not a lot of description here other than it's a bear who eats a lot. Eat much meat. So this is a bear with a ferocious appetite. It's a huge animal. And so it'll eat a lot. It'll devour not just meat like food. It devours people. It devours kingdoms. It devours substance. The third is a leopard with four wings. Now, okay, leopard, known for their sneaky attacks, known for their speed, right? You've seen it on a National Geographic show or something like that where a leopard can just crawl ever so carefully, cat-like in its quietness and sneakiness, and then it'll pounce. And if it doesn't get that animal he's after at the first pounce, he can run up to 60 miles an hour or something. So the leopard is known for the sneaky attacks and the speed, but it has four wings, which just increases his ability to hunt. I mean, a leopard is fast on the ground, but what if a leopard could also fly? A leopard is agile on a mountain face, but what if he doesn't even need to just hug a mountain? He can also just leap off and fly down to the bottom of the mountain. And he has four heads. The commentaries either refer this to a four times the smarter kind of thing. He's a guy with four brains. Or four heads looking in four directions. He sees in all directions. Nothing gets past him. He's a leopard with his speed, with his agility, with his hunting. But he has four wings, and he has four heads. He's either four times as smart or seeing in every direction. The fourth one doesn't have quite as much imagery. It says that it's dreadful, terrifying, and strong in verse 7, with iron teeth. And it says it devoured and crushed what remained, or trampled down the remainder with its feet in the New American Standard. The remainder here is the remainder of these kings that are left, or it's the remainder of the kingdoms that are left. I mean, whatever's left. After you go through these three kings, all about devouring, all about taking, all about taking over, now you have the last one who tramples whatever's left of these kings and tramples whatever's left of those kingdoms. What about this? Verse 7, they had 10 horns. The fourth beast has 10 horns. We're told the 10 horns equal 10 kings, 10 different kingdoms. Look at verse 23 and 24. The fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all other kingdoms. He'll devour the whole earth and tread it down. So the fourth one is the worst of them all. And he produces 10 horns or 10 kings, which may mean either 10 kingdoms or 10 successive kings that follow after him. But remember, there's the 11th horn. Remember that one? Remember verse 8? In the middle of the 10 horns, on the fourth beast, if you can keep this all straight, one springs up, a little horn springs up that grows to be bigger than the other ones and pulls three of them out by the root. Look at verse 24. Here's the explanation from the angel. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise. Another will arise after them. He'll be different from the previous ones and he'll subdue 3 kings. So the last one, this 11th, is defeating the others and worst of them all. So here's the summary of the four beasts. Four terrifying, devouring, conquering kings who are violent in their conquering. The worst one of them all, the fourth one, produces something that leads to 10 kings or 10 kingdoms. And these are worse than the fourth beast. And one of them, an 11th, rises and is worse than all of them altogether and devours even some of his own, of those horns there. Now, a lot of ink has been spilt on what these kingdoms represent. So some people would say this is easy. Four kingdoms. It's Babylonian kingdom, Medo-Persia kingdom, Greek kingdom, and the Roman Empire. Maybe. But that might miss the point. I don't think that's the point. I understand the desire to want to apply this as far as we can. But I think that this is a cosmic picture that isn't so specific to time and specific kingdoms. Do you know those pictures at the mall? They're posters, usually, and you see it also in advertising as well. It'll be a picture that you stand far back from, and you can make out the overall contours of it, but it's made up of tiny little squares. Now, a lot of times, the tiny little squares are their own little picture. So if you got up really close, you'd go, oh, wow, look, each one of the squares is its own little painting. But the goal is to stand back and to not intensely focus, but instead to almost relax and kind of almost blur your eyes a little bit. And you see, oh, it is the Mona Lisa, but it's made up of little squares. No one goes up to the little squares and goes, wait a minute, maybe this is telling a story. Let's start at the first one. Maybe this is like a pictorial story. You kind of go, well, that's a picture of this. And then in this story, this happens. And you try to read it all the way through. And 10 hours later, you maybe have some sort of weird story. No one does that. We kind of know that the point of it is just to notice these little small squares, but then really to stand back and see the broader picture. It's different than those other pictures you may have seen. I don't know if they're called holograms or what they are, but I remember when I was in junior high, these things came out, and it'd be like, instead of squares, blotches. And you're supposed to stare at this thing for, you know, like that, and aneurysm happens right here, veins. And if you stare really hard, then a hand would come out. It'd be almost three-dimensional or something, and, you know, you'd be there with your friends, and, you know, you didn't see it. Everyone saw the hand. You finally give up. You go, oh, yeah, I saw the hand. All right, let's go. But man, it takes a long time to see it. Not everyone can see it. And it's not there. It's not on the surface. That is not this kind of literature. It's instead more like the squares. You're not supposed to count the specific things. If someone painted a political cartoon of a Democrat donkey and a Republican elephant doing a tug of war with a rope, no one would go, what does the rope represent? No one cares about that. They go, oh, yeah, Democrats and Republicans are fighting again. That's all it means. They're having a little tug of war over these policies and those policies. No one goes, wait a minute, how many threads are in that rope? Is that a donkey wearing? No, he's not wearing anything. What does that mean? No, you see, you don't try to read into it more than you're supposed to. You know, with a political cartoon, like an eagle with its claws around the throat of a bear. It means very little nowadays, but in the 80s, that clearly would have meant America is finally taking the upper hand on what? Russia, the bear, right? That's how we're supposed to read this kind of thing. And we have to keep in mind that it's written in uncertain, suffering times. God did not give these revelations to Daniel, and then through Daniel to us, and through Daniel also to Daniel's people, the Jews of that time. He didn't do it to confuse them, nor did he give it to them so that they would just be kept busy and distracted while all the hard stuff's going on. Kind of like a crossword puzzle. It's not like God gave this weird crossword puzzle to his people while they were going through suffering times. You know, a crossword puzzle for a lot of you, some of you just love them, so you have to do them, but some people just bring them on planes. It's the only time they get, you know, I'll grab a crossword puzzle, and you know, it kills time. God did not give a crossword puzzle for us to be distracted with. He gave us a big picture here, and we miss out if we see the big picture. All right, that's the first vision. The second one is the Ancient of Days here, verses 9 and 10. Daniel says, I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him, and thousands upon thousands were attending him. Myriads and myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. This is practically the same description of Jesus in Revelation 1. Verse 9 is Revelation 1, almost to the T, about Jesus. In verse 10, if you want to go read these later, is almost a concise description of what John sees in Revelation as the throne room of heaven, Revelation 4 and 5. So if you want to write it down, verse 9 is Revelation 1. It hints at Revelation 1, or John looks back to verse 9 as he writes Revelation 1. And verse 10 would refer to Revelation 4 and 5 in the New Testament. Now, in the New Testament, in Revelation, these refer to Jesus. Here, it's clear that this is not Jesus, but the Father, if we're going to be specific about our Trinitarian reference here. And that's clear because of the next one, the Son of Man here, verses 13 and 14, which I think is Jesus, and I'll tell you why a little bit later. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. We'll come back to this Son of Man reference in just a bit, but notice here that the first 14 verses have painted the teams for us. Two teams. On one team, four beasts, 10 horns, small horn. On the other team, just two, the Ancient of Days, the Son of Man, probably the Father and the Son of God, also called the Son of Man in the New Testament. So, now let's talk about the interpretation, the main themes that we can conclude from this, that we can draw from this, and we can maybe even apply to our lives. So, the first of these is this theme, the rise and fall of mighty empires. That's what this passage is about. It's a cosmic, weird, apocalyptic story or vision about the rise and fall of mighty empires, which kill and conquer each other. Look at verse 20. They kill and conquer each other. The remaining 10 horns that were on its head, the other horn which came up before them, the three of them fell because the small horn beat them. And that horn which had eyes like had eyes and a mouth uttering great boast was larger in appearance than its associate. So there's this comparison going on. There's this rivalry going on. In verse 23, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, and he'll be different from all other kingdoms. He'll devour the whole earth, including other kingdoms, and he'll tread it down and he'll crush them. And they blaspheme God as well. As they kill and they conquer each other, they blaspheme God. Look at verse 25. He will speak out against the Most High. And in verse 25, he'll oppress the saints. He will wear down the saints of the Most High. So they'll kill and conquer each other. They will blaspheme God. And they'll oppress, they will kill the saints. Look at verse 21. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints, God's people, in overpowering them. Now, when's the last time you've seen an empire like this? Some of you will immediately, you know, some of you will say Iraq, some of you will say Nazi Germany. Maybe this seems like we're almost on the cusp of being done with this sort of thing. Maybe thanks to the UN, we're now to a point where you got to be a really dumb leader, your country, to just decide you're going to take over stuff. You know, people will come in and try to stop you. Genocide, maybe we think that we're almost on the cusp of being done with mass genocide. Maybe. Not likely. It's still happening today. Even if this seems to us like it's overstated. Maybe we think in our geopolitical sophistication today, this seems a little overstated, that there's this constant conquering and reconquering of kings and kingdoms, a constant land grab through war, that there's this constant blaspheming of God, and that there's this constant war on the saints. Maybe it seems overstated, but you know what? If it is overstated, it only fits the style of the literature. Remember? Everything to the nth degree. But it's really not that overstated. When you think of persecution of Christians in Burma today, in India, in China, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iran, the persecution of Christians is so different there than what it means for us to be persecuted as Christians here in America. We tend to view everything not just through the now lens. We tend to view everything, don't we, through the America lens, the me lens, well, I don't see it. It seems safe here. It doesn't seem like my country's doing that. And maybe some would say, well, yes, it is. And maybe some would say, no, it's not. But regardless of that debate, you think of the genocide in Kosovo. You think of the genocide in Rwanda, in Darfur, going on right now. It wasn't that long ago that Hitler had to be stopped. Think of the taking over of countries, which, yeah, that's, you think of Hitler, but you think of Saddam Hussein in Kuwait. You think of Vietnam just in, a generation ago. A lot happened more in the past than now, but don't misunderstand. It's happening today. And remember that this is being written in a time when this would be absolutely normal. In these days, kings would either conquer or they would be conquered. There was no king who said, I'm Switzerland. I'm neutral. You're dead, is what you are, and your kingdom's gone. Because there's no neutral. This is this political who's on your side. It's jockeying for power. And it's not waged with votes. It's not won with these subtleties. It's not dangling carrots in front of the countries in these days like we do today. You know, we can get a country to do what we want if we just send enough money. But here it's conquering or be conquered. And keep in mind, these kings are monarchs with absolute power. These kings are monarchs. Remember what Lord Acton said? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. There were just the first hints of what we call rights and freedoms. The seedlings that would develop into democracy much, much, much later. But the seedlings of these rights and freedoms were just starting to be considered in the time of Daniel. In fact, under Cyrus, the king who Daniel serves under. But these are hardcore, real kings who do their will. And the law of the land is conquer or be conquered. Look at this phrase in verse 25, the end of it. The last line says this will happen for a time, times, and half a time. Whew. Well, that's a tough one. You're probably thinking, if you know anything about this, no, it's not. That's 3.5 years. Well, a lot of people have said that. It's warranted a lot of debate, this little phrase, time, times, and half a time. And some people say it's 3.5. Time is 1, times is 2, half a time is a half, so let's add them up, 3.5. But notice it doesn't say years. I wonder if we bring a cultural concept to a passage like this, and we just automatically think 3.5. But it didn't say years, did it? Just a time. It's unspecific. In fact, the Hebrew word can mean seasons. Not just years. It could be seasons. And notice when it says times, that's not necessarily two. That's just plural. Now, what does this mean? Remember, think general. Back up. Don't stare at the squares and hurt your brain. Just back up. What's it mean? Well, it means that there will be this constant flux of kings coming and conquering. And some will be in power and be bad and persecute the saints for a time. Some will do it for times, plural. Some will only do it for half a time. There's a difference here. Some kings are worse than others. Some kings are more powerful than others. Some kings are more accepting of God's people than other kings are. But some have it last for a time, and some have it last for double that time, and some, well, it'll be just half that time. I think the point is just, until Jesus comes back, there'll be wicked kings with wicked kingdoms. They'll come, they'll go, some will be worse than others, some will last longer than others, but until then there is a real battle. We don't know the time. I think that's exactly the point of why we shouldn't camp out and try to go 3.5 years precisely. It might be missing the point because maybe it's vague on purpose. Maybe it's time, times, and half a time. Just to say, we don't know how long that king's going to be in power. We don't know how long that king's going to be killing Christians. We don't know whether that president's going to get a second term. We don't know. Time, times, half a time. We just know they come, they go. And evil so often manifests itself in power and control. Secondly, there's the victory of God and the redemption of His people. The victory of God and the redemption of His people is found in verse 18. The saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom for all ages to come. So in the end, the Lord will win. And His saints who have been persecuted will receive a kingdom. Verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Or verse 27. Then the sovereignty and dominion and greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. Psalm 2 verse 8 said, ask of me and I will give you the nations as your inheritance. God says to His people, ask of me, I'll give you the nations as your inheritance. I'll give you the very ends of the earth as your possession. Remember the Beatitudes where Jesus said, blessed are the gentle, not the warmongers, not those who conquer and kill for power and corruption. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. In fact, you can read the Beatitudes in Matthew 5 with Daniel 7 in mind. That God's people are a persecuted people. That they're up against a warring, evil people. But they're to be peacemakers. They're to be gentle. They're to take their persecution. And they will become sons of God. They will inherit the earth. They will be great in the land. Now let's notice this third thing here. The Son of Man is the key. The third interpretive thing here is the Son of Man is the key to it. We have to remember why the Son of Man was brought up. Remember, the problem is these four beasts and the 10 horns and then the small horn that grows up to be a bad big horn. Then the solution is going to be that the saints win at the end. They're persecuted, but they'll win. Jesus will come back and he'll kick butt. He'll take over. He'll put all kingdoms under His kingship. The means of that happening are the verses before, verses 9 and 10 about the Ancient of Days. He's on His throne. He can give His kingdom to whoever He wishes. And verses 13 and 14 about the Son of Man. Now, is this Son of Man Jesus? Oh, absolutely. Let me give you a few reasons why this is Jesus. Notice the reference in verse 13 that He is coming with the clouds. Coming with the clouds. In the Old Testament, clouds are a frequent reference to deity. In Psalm 97, clouds and thick darkness surround Him. It's usually God's vesture in the Old Testament. It's usually His garment. It says, Psalm 104, He makes the clouds His chariot. So clouds, a reference to deity here. So the Son of Man has to be both a man, because He's just called a Son of Man, and He has to be God. because of these clouds here. The clouds in the New Testament are also a part of the description of Jesus' second coming. Revelation 1:7. He is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him. Matthew and Mark quote Jesus as saying the same exact thing as Revelation 1. He's coming with the clouds. The Son of Man reference in Daniel 7. Jesus uses this reference of himself more than any other reference. When he speaks of himself, when he says things like, the Son of Man didn't come to do that. The Son of Man did come to do this. More than any other point of reference, he calls himself the Son of Man. Again, to emphasize his servantry, he's just a man, but also to point to passages like this where the Son of Man is obviously far more than just a man. And then notice in verse 13, notice the Son of Man comes up to the Ancient of Days. He's on his throne. He comes up to the Ancient of Days in verse 13. And in verse 14, it was given him. So it sounds like there's a test. He came up and was presented before the Ancient of Days. And then verse 14, this kingdom, this whole world, the dominion of every people, nation, and every language is given to him. This is so similar to an exchange given to Jesus. A scroll from the Father to Jesus the Son in Revelation 5. You might be familiar with it. Let me read it. Who is worthy to open the book or the scroll and to break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the book or to look into it. Then I began to weep greatly, John says, because no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. And one of them said to me, stop weeping. Behold, the Lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, he has overcome so as to open the seals. And he came, that is Jesus, came and took the book out of the right hand, or the scroll out of the right hand of him who sits on the throne. So think scroll, don't think book, even though a lot of translations have book here. Think scroll with, remember, seven seals. What is the scroll? It's God's plan. It's God's plan, and it's the title deed to the earth. Jesus inherits the earth. Who is worthy in Revelation 5? Who is worthy to take over God's kingdom, his dominion, his rule? Who is worthy? No one was worthy to enact the seals, the opening of the enactment of God's plan. Who's worthy to do that? Just one, the Son of Man, Jesus. So let me give you some quick points of application as we close. The application for today. One point of application is about confidence. Where do we put our confidence when we're going through suffering? Where do you turn? Where do you want to find your confidence? We can endure suffering like them, like those in Daniel's time, like those in Revelation's time, because he will settle all injustices. We need a look of the big picture. We need to see the end from the beginning. We know how it ends. Jesus wins. He will resolve every injustice. It will either get settled in hell or on the cross, but every injustice will get settled. But not yet. Are you okay with the not yet? I mean, it's going to get settled. It's practically now, but it's not yet. Until he comes, there will be bad kings. Until he comes, there will be bad bosses. Until he comes, there will be hard times. But have your confidence in him who has practically settled it now and forever and is coming again to perfectly settle it in the end. It also reminds us, doesn't it, because there's so much here about governments and kings and kingdoms. It reminds us to not put our confidence in governments and nations. They have a purpose. Read Romans 13. If you're not sure what the purpose of government is in the Bible, does God care? Or could we just live in anarchy and every man to himself kind of thing? No, God is pro-government. But that's way different than thinking that government is our hope. I mean, maybe for us in the U.S., 2007-2008 period, what it means for us is we are to vote, but we can't think that the battle is won in the vote. That's not the battle. The battle is not the right guy getting elected. The battle's not won in the vote. Remember Ephesians 6. Our struggle isn't against flesh and blood in ballots, we could say. It's against rulers and powers and against world forces of this darkness. It's against spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Don't forget where the battle lies. Vote and put on the armor of God and pray, because the good guy won't always get elected. And by the way, what is a good guy anyway? You know, I mean, you might think I'm a good guy, but I'd stink at that job. And man, I heard the saying recently, any guy who's able to get all the way to president probably isn't qualified to be there. I don't know if that's true, but it is kind of funny. There's an application about the nations here. The nations in the Old Testament is often negative. It's often those bad people, the wicked people, the nations. The nations in the New Testament is opportunity. Go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. In the end, God will have redeemed a people from every tongue, tribe, kindred, and nation. The question is, are we on the Lord's side? Are we of His spiritual nation? Are we of His kingdom? It is in black and white terms in apocalyptic literature. We like to view it because it's politically correct to do so. We like to do shades of gray. Well, I mean, you know, it's not so black and white. Shades of gray. You know, that guy is worse than that guy, but it's shades of gray. So often in Scripture, it's black and white. There's the Lord's side, and then there's not. There are two destinations. There's heaven, there's hell. When He returns, He will either come back and you will be on one of two sides of His sword. You'll either be behind His sword, cheering Him on, or you will be at the other end of His sword. So it's about Jesus the King. There's an application here about Jesus because His death and His resurrection has already inaugurated this. It's as good as done. His kingdom is here. He said, "My kingdom is here. It's not of this world." So we don't fight, but it's here. And so He's won the right for, according to Philippians 2, for every knee to bow, every tongue confess that He is the King. He's the King of kings and Lord of lords. Colossians 2 tells us, in reference to the cross and to the resurrection, that in it He disarmed rulers and authorities, and He made a public display of them. Get this. Jesus on the cross at the hands of the Romans is trumping them. He is making a public display of His victory and a repudiation of their kingship, their authority, their ruling. He is the King, and one day He will bring every kingdom under His own, and He will be the consummate, full, and complete King. According to Revelation 5, He did this because He's the Lion, and He's the what? The Lamb. He's the King, and He's the sacrificed one for our sins. Because of that, He is the one who can take God's plan. So here's my closing question. He's coming again. Is this your long-awaited delight? Do you have an eye for His coming, for eternity, that day, that longing for it getting settled? It will get settled. Trust Him. Don't think instant gratification. Don't let the consumerism of our day preach to you instant solving of problems, instant gratification. I want a pill for joy. I want a pill for that. Fix it now, Jesus. Be patient. Be patient. Wait on Him. Wait on Him. In this world, you'll have tribulation, but He's overcome the world. Is it your long-awaited delight, or is it your often-ignored doom? Is He coming for your rescue, or is He coming back for your recompense? Two destinies, two kinds of people, one King.